Where's the... be in Leviticus 4 through 7. So after today, we'll be more than 25% done with the book of Leviticus. But we're looking at chapters 4 through 7 today on the offerings that were mandatory for some kind of sin. And we'll talk about how those differ from the sacrifices that we looked at in previous classes. But let's just remind ourselves of, here's one way that you can outline the book, or a few ways on this chart that you can outline the book, that the first 17 chapters are showing you how to be able to approach God. And you remember that in Exodus, that after God's glory came onto the tabernacle, that, so God's glory comes on the tabernacle, and then what happens to the people or to the leaders? Are they able to enter the tabernacle? No. And so in Leviticus 1, God is speaking from the tent. And then in Numbers chapter 1, God is speaking from within the tent. And so the difference is that in the book of Leviticus, you're learning how to be able to approach God. So 1 through 17, this is how you can be reconciled to Him. 18 through 27, this is what it looks like to walk and to live for Him. Can you think of any other books of the Bible that are structured in this way? That you've got the provision of sacrifice, or another way to say it, God's love for you. And then the second half of the book is how you show your love for God. Romans does that. Ephesians does that. Colossians does that. So this is a kind of structure that you see in other books of the Bible. And you can also remember it with two S's. You've got sacrifices, and then you've got sanctification. We're in this section right here where we're looking at the foundational five kinds of offerings that the Israelites could offer. And Lord willing, in 2 weeks, we'll look at the priests who would make those offerings. And then we'll move on to another section. And so all these laws are given over the course of 1 month at Mount Sinai. And let's just say a couple things to get us oriented to what we're looking at this morning. We brought this up before, but this has been a newer thought that I've been thinking a lot about with regards to Leviticus, is that for the original audience, these commands would not have been burdensome. And Janice pointed my attention to Psalm 100, and it's one of the short psalms. Let me just go ahead and read Psalm 100. It's a psalm for giving thanks. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come into His presence with singing. Know that the Lord, He is God. It is He who made us, and we are His. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture. Enter His gates with thanksgiving and His courts with praise. Give thanks to Him, bless His name, for the Lord is good. His steadfast love endures forever, and His faithfulness to all generations. What's the attitude of the psalmist as they get to approach the courts of the Lord with their sacrifices, with all these things that they would be bringing? Is it, oh man, look at all these drudged details that we have to go through and how much of a bummer it is that we have to follow these procedures? That's not at all what their attitude would have been. And I think that's an important thing to think about when we consider the book of Leviticus, because how much more joyful should we be over the sacrifice that has been given to us, all of these kinds of things. But you've got God becoming the neighbor of the nation of Israel, and it's not like, oh, here, He just descended, and you're like, what, we have to do all this to draw near to Him? No, you would want to know how to do it. And so these instructions are not burdensome. The flow of thought, the emphasis of what we've been looking at leading up through chapter 7 today, there's different things being emphasized in these chapters. The first three chapters, anybody remember what three offerings we talked about 2 weeks ago? Burnt, grain, and the peace offering. Very good. Yeah. And so those are the three that we looked at last time. But the thing that gets emphasized in Leviticus 1 through 3 is the procedure of how the offerings were made. Now, I think one of the reasons for that is because when we look at the guilt and the sin offering today, that it's like the sin offering will have almost the same procedure as the peace offering. So the first three, but it has a different purpose. And so for the first three kinds of offerings, these are like the foundational ones. And all the other offerings have some kind of strong similarity to the first three in how the procedure works. So you emphasize the procedures first. And then in chapters 4, verse 1 through 6, 7, where we talk about these other kind of offerings, it's going to emphasize the occasion when you would have to give it. And then it'll say, and it'll be like the peace offering or whatever. Does that make sense? All right. So then the starting in chapter 6, verse 8, through the rest of chapter 7, you're going to have an emphasis on instructions that are just for the priests. And this is going to be the first time in Leviticus that the priests are specifically addressed. And so everything up to chapter 6, verse 7, this is supposed to be disseminated to the whole congregation because everybody has to know how these sacrifices work. Okay, any comments or questions about that? All right, so the outline of what we're looking at today is chapter 4, verse 1 through 5:13. This is the instruction for the sin offerings. 5:14 through 6:7 are the guilt offerings. And then, you've got these instructions for the priests. Here's this chart again. It's on the printout, which will be up here for anybody who wants it afterwards. The first three offerings, the burnt, the grain, the peace, these are all voluntary or thank you offerings. You gave it because God did something kind to you, or you were thankful for some provision in your life or something like that. By the way, anybody know what the word Holocaust means? The word Holocaust means like to burn. And the Hebrew word for burnt offering is olah, which is where we get Holocaust. And so when you talk about the burnt offering, it's related to the word Holocaust. That's just an interesting detail there. But these ones are, we talked about these ones last time. We talked about the details there. We'll say some more about some of these things when we get to the instructions for the priest. But here, we're looking at what I'm calling the mandatory offerings, the I'm sorry offerings. And so this is when you've sinned in some way, and you have to make either the sin offering or the guilt offering. And this chart, the purpose of bringing this up right now is not to look at it forever, because it's going to be on the printout, and we'll look at more of these details in just a second. But that's what we're looking at today. Anything anybody wants to comment on with that? All right, we're covering four chapters today, so we're not going to be reading everything, but I do want to start out by reading chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, as we get the introduction to the sin offering. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commands about the things not to be done, and does any of them," now we're just stop there for a second, because he's going to tell them how to do this. It says at the beginning here, the Lord spoke, so this is a new section, and he says, if anybody sins, in what kind of way? Okay, so this is not for high-handed sins. Remember in Numbers 15, where if somebody sins with a high hand, that's kind of like looking at what God says and somebody says, I see that's what he says, but I'm going to do what I want to do still. This is a different kind of sin. This is unintentional sin. So here's my question. I thought sin was a choice. So, how could a sin ever be unintentional? Okay, good. So, maybe you're aware of a law, but you didn't realize that you were breaking it at the moment or whatever. I think about Abimelech in Genesis 20. Remember when he takes Abraham's wife, Sarah, and God is going to punish him, and he says, I didn't know. Would that be an unintentional sin, in a sense? Yeah. Maybe another situation would be when you're not aware of what the law says. I remember when Samantha and I were new converts and we were like, we don't know where we need to grow because we don't even know what the Bible says yet. And so you might be unaware, or you might be misled to do the wrong thing, but you thought it was okay. And now I cite Leviticus 19 up there because everybody just remembers Leviticus 19, 23 to 25, right? Come on, guys. It's the passage about if you plant a tree and you have to wait for the tree to be 3 years old before you can eat the fruit of the tree. And so what happens if, like, you think, you're maybe, like, walking and gleaning in somebody's field or something and you didn't know, and it looked like it was maybe older than 3 years old and you accidentally eat one of... So, like, you'd be misled to do the wrong thing, but you thought, like, you know, this was okay, right? So that's what I think some ideas of unintentional sins would be. Now, what does the word sin mean? Yeah, the Hebrew word is chada, and it means to miss the mark. The mark is determined by God. We don't get to be the ones that determine what the mark is. And one of my favorite illustrations in the Old Testament of sin is, does anybody know which tribe was left-handed that could sling stones really good? Benjamin. In the book of Judges, chapter 20, verse 16, it talks about 700 chosen men who were left-handed, like me. Everyone could sling a stone at the hare and not miss. That word for miss is the word for sin. So it's like these people would just, they would hit the target every time. So what is the target that Christians are supposed to hit? Godliness, that we're supposed to be made in God's image to be reflectors of Him. So every time we fail to do that, we're failing to be a human being the way God created us.
Paul said he received mercy because he did it ignorantly and unbelievingly.
Yes, yes. So you got people like Paul, and even Jesus will say that forgive them, they know not what they do, things like that. Good, good. All right, one other thing to say about this. You might go back to Leviticus chapter 1, verse 4 and remember that the burnt offering atoned for sin. So why do we still need a sin offering? Have you ever wondered that? So the burnt offering atones for sin. Why do we need the sin offering? What was that? Okay, we keep sinning. What we're going to see with the burnt offering is that it just kind of seems like a general atonement. Kind of like the general acknowledgement that I am not perfect. But when you look at the sin offering proper, it's for like particular things that you've done that you can identify. So it's almost like the burnt offering is kind of like this remembering that I'm not perfect, and the sin offering is the specific confession of a specific sin. That's how I'm seeing that, and that's the best I can do with it at this time. Does anybody have any comments on that? Okay. All right, so one other thing to say about the sin offering. This is something that has bothered a lot of people, especially like people like my mom, for example. The sin offering is supposed to be offered in situations where it's really clear the person has not sinned. But the text makes it seem like they sinned. So why are you having to do a sin offering for something that we know is not a sin? For example, Leviticus 5 talks about touching something that's unclean. Like you have to help bury somebody and the dead body is unclean. Well, I have to offer a sin offering for that? Or you think about a mother gives birth, and after a mother gives birth, she has to offer a sin offering. As if giving birth is a sin? Or another example is to cleanse a leper. Like a leper has to give a sin offering. As if it was sinful to contract this disease. So why is it called a sin offering? Anybody wondered about that? Anybody been offended by that before? Right. But do you see the struggle, though? Like my mom looks at, especially the one in Leviticus 12, and says, so the Bible says that giving birth is a sin. How silly. So what do we say? Jerry? Yep. Right. Yes. Yes. And I think some more recent translations prefer to call it the purification offering. Because the point of this is that, yeah, is this procedure followed if you've committed an unintentional sin? Yeah, the procedure. But can the same procedure be followed for something that's not sin, but has still made me impure ritually, so I can't go to the temple? So that's the idea. So sin and impurity, like giving birth, like being a leper, which doesn't mean you're sinful. That's not the point of this. But sin and impurity both defile and therefore both require purification. That's why you go through the same kind of procedure as a sin offering. But it's not saying that you have sinned because you gave birth. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's just a couple introductory things about the sin offering. Now, what we're going to see happen in this chapter is it will descend from the people in people that have the highest amount of influence to the lower amount of influence. So it says, what if a high priest or the anointed priest sins? Look at verse 3. If it is the anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for a sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. All right, notice how serious this is. If the high priest sins, why would that be problematic for the nation? What was that? He can't go before God, so that's not good. And he's bringing guilt on the people. Is it because he can't intercede for them and their guilt is piling up? Is it because he influenced them in some kind of bad way or something like that? We don't get all the details of that. But what is the offering that he has to bring? A bull. That is the most expensive, valuable offering of all the ones that you can give. So that's the one that the high priest is supposed to bring. The procedure follows very much the peace offering procedure. And so what he does is, except there's a strong difference. Look at verses 7 and 8 after the animal is killed. It says, "And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord that is in the tent of meeting, and all the rest of the blood of the bull he should pour out on the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, and the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails." All right, so that should remind you of the peace offering, the way that they handle the fat and stuff like that, and what they do with it. But the blood, where is it taken? Right. Yes, so it's the altar that's right by the most holy place. So you sprinkle some there. Where is all the other blood sprinkled? On what altar in the previous sacrifices? Yeah, what is that one called? The burnt offering altar or the brazen altar. So you sprinkle the blood there. But in this case, if the high priest has sinned, this is like the only sacrifice, this one along with if the whole congregation sins, then the blood is brought to this place. Now, we'll say more about that when we wrap up this class this morning. So that's part of the procedure there. The fat, kidneys, lobe of the liver are burned like the peace offering. But the rest of the animal, the stuff that you could eat, like the meat, for example, all of it's burned outside the camp. Which means that for the high priest that sins, who might ordinarily eat from the meat, he doesn't get to benefit from his sin in any way. It all has to be taken outside the camp. Jesus suffered outside the camp. We're going to see the ideas of being outside the camp quite a bit in Leviticus. So that's what happens if the high priest sins. Now, the text moves then in verse 13 to what if the whole nation has sinned? And it brings up the question, okay, there's the corporate sin of the nation. Is it possible that the high priest, that this is connected, the high priest brings guilt on them, so the high priest has to make an offering for whatever he did, and then because he led the congregation in sin, everybody has to also have this offering as well? But it's going to be like the same procedure. There's going to be one difference, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But just notice, first of all, this idea. Can corporate sin exist? What is the responsibility when there is some kind of corporate sin? And by corporate, it could be corporately within a family, within a church, within a nation, whatever. That does what? Okay, but in this case, it's like shared amongst everybody. But the leader needs to take the charge to do something about it, which is perhaps why it starts with the high priest. But I think the idea is that the whole group has to acknowledge their sin. Can you think of any times in the Bible where the Israelites sinned corporately? Okay, golden calf, good. What else? Yep, they refuse the promised land. They don't trust God. What else? Yep. Right. Yes. Isn't it kind of cool studying Leviticus after we've studied Numbers? Like, we're going backwards in time. There's something about it that's, like, helping me make more connections. But I think about, like, the Gibeonites in the book of Joshua. When the Gibeonites come and they don't consult the Lord and they get deceived. I think about Lamentations and Daniel chapter 9, that we have sinned and we need to own this. Is there any times in the New Testament where churches corporately need to acknowledge their sin? Right. Can you guys think of any section of Scripture where there's something close to like eight churches of Asia? Seven churches of Asia in Revelation 2 and 3. You got these churches that are addressed. And the churches begin and end with the worst ones, with Ephesus and Laodicea. They've lost their first love, they're lukewarm, and then in between you've got a mishmash of some that are like kind of good and some that are good and some that are mixed, not so good. But the idea being that corporate sin is a real thing. That if there's a church or there's a nation or there's a family that have tolerated things that aren't right, there needs to be a public acknowledgement of that. And so in this situation, the procedure, it's the same as when the high priest sins, but in this case, instead of the high priest laying hands on the bull, the elders lay hands on the bull, and then they just do the same kind of stuff that they did before. Any comments or questions about that? Yeah, Teresa? In 1 Corinthians 5? Yeah. Yeah, that would be another situation. That's a good example of that as well, that the corporate kind of acknowledgement of what you guys are tolerating. Good. Okay. All right, so that's the sin offering for the high priest, for the whole nation, and then the chapter just moves down to talking about, well, what if it's a leader of the people? Which would mean that it's a non-priest leader, because we already dealt with the high priest. So who would be the non-priest leaders in Israel? Elders? Yep. Yeah, the kings. So you've got kings, prophets, tribal heads, elders, all of those. So apply to them. What they have to bring is a male goat. The blood is not brought into the holy place. It's applied to the brazen altar as it was with other sacrifices. And in this case, the officiating priest gets a tip by eating the meat. Leviticus 6 talks about that. And so that's what happens if a leader sins. If an Israelite sins, then they can do similar thing as for a leader, but they bring a goat or they can bring a sheep. We don't need to read those passages. But let me bring up one kind of puzzle about all of this. One of the things that's repeated all throughout this chapter is that if you do these sacrifices, it results in forgiveness. But what does Hebrews 10 say about the blood of bulls and goats? They couldn't take away sin. So clearly the atheists are right and we should give up. How do we resolve this? Because the text keeps saying they'll be forgiven. What was that? Faith in what? Yes, what did all this look forward to? Yeah, to Christ. So they were doing what they could on faith in what Moses said. And God being beyond time, knowing that this is going to happen one day. Hebrews 9, 14 or 15 talks about how all the people that made these kinds of offerings in the Old Testament, that Jesus' blood covers them. And so that would be maybe one thing to say about that. Anything else you guys want to say through chapter 4? Sewell?
I noticed that there was a difference that the leader had to bring a male.
Yep.
The one with the Israelite
is the female. Right. A goat or a sheep. Right. I think it's difference in value, something like that. And you see then that the chapter moves from most influential, leaders really influential, the whole congregation, obviously. But yeah, but for the higher position of leadership, the greater sacrifice to be forgiven it takes, I think. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, when we had chickens, we had to get rid of the guy, you know. He was trying to kill Samantha and the kids. But, okay. okay, so we've got that as the forgiveness there for the sin offering. Then we move to, okay, when were the sin offerings required? What would be some opportunities or some times where this would be mandatory? Look at chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet does not speak, he shall bear his iniquity. Or if anyone touches an unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean wild animal or a carcass of an unclean livestock or a carcass of something of unclean swarming things, and it is hidden from him, and he has become unclean, and he realizes his guilt, or if he touches human uncleanness or whatever sort of uncleanness may be with the which one becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him, when he comes to know it and realizes his guilt, or if anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good, any sort of rash oath that people swear, it is and it is hidden from him, when he comes to know it and he realizes his guilt in any of these, and then we'll stop there for a second. All right, so here's just some of the times where he would have to do this. The first time would be failure to testify in court. Now, the text doesn't say why somebody wouldn't do it, but the expectation is that you, if you were a witness for something, that you do come forward, and if you don't, it's a sin of silence. And so if maybe, like, you were really busy, like, you intended to be there, but, like, the goats got loose or something like that, like, that's an unintentional sin, maybe in a situation like that. But the expectation is that you testify, or you contact an unclean animal or a person. We talked about how that in and of itself is not sin. But what would become sin is if you left it unaddressed. Yeah, Cherry?
That first one about failure to respond to test, when Jesus was put under oath by the high priest on his trial,
Yep. Right,
I said, yes, I am son of it.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, he testified. He followed the law. Like, he did what they asked him, you know, what the question was.
Even though it was self-incriminating.
And it's interesting you bring that up, because the next one is, if you make a rash oath, who was making a rash oath while Jesus was confessing who he was? Peter. Both of them are being put on trial, but, like, Jesus is confessing his identity for people like Peter who hide their identity so that they can... There's a really interesting kind of, like, just juxtaposition going on there. Okay, so that's some situations when it would be required. Can you think of anybody else making any rash oaths in the Bible?
Jephthah.
Should he have kept his oath? Or would that be a rash oath that instead of keeping your oath, you give an offering because it was silly to say such a thing? I think passages like this say that somebody like Jephthah, he should not have kept his oath, but they're so upside down in their morality at that point that he doesn't know that, you know, that... What was that?
Herod made a rash oath.
Yeah, Herod made a rash oath with having John the Baptist's head removed from his body. Any other things?
That were made an oath to not even to
kill
Paul.
Yes, in Acts 22.
What happened to him?
Right, that's right. Yep.
Saul made an oath that none of the people were to eat.
Yeah, and it's like
we're in battle right
now. We need the strength from the food, and then
one of them eats the honey and everything. So yeah. Okay, good. So that would be some examples of rash oaths. There was a provision if you agreed to do something that you shouldn't have done or whatever. Okay. Notice though, look at verses 5 and 6. When he realizes his guilt in any of these things and confesses the sin he has committed, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation for the sin that he has committed a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him and for his sin. Okay, so he confesses. What does it mean to confess?
To admit exactly what you did.
Yeah, to agree with what God says about it, to admit exactly what you did.
Anybody know the Greek word for confession?
It's homologio or something like that. The Greek word for
a word is logos or logos. And so homo, what does homo mean? The same. So confess means to say the same words. That God calls it lying. I want to call it a boo-boo. Like, we want to try to lessen the words that God uses, but a real confession means I will acknowledge, based on your terminology, what I did, rather than trying to wiggle away from it and feel a little less guilty or something like that, because it's too hard to say that I really stole something. Like, I was actually in need, but, you know, whatever. So you have to confess, and confession is necessary for the forgiveness here, but at the same time, it doesn't remove the penalty. You still have to bring... the sin offering. You still have to do something about the severed relationship with God that happened from that. Okay. Anything you guys want to say about that? All right. One final thing about the sin offering.
is that there were special provisions for people that could not bring the animals. So in chapter 5, verse 7, the first thing it begins by saying is, but if he cannot afford a lamb, and then there's different things that the person could bring. They could bring birds in verses 7 through 10. They could either bring two pigeons or two turtle doves. Any ideas on why they would have to bring two birds where other people would just have to bring one goat?
Not as much blood.
Yeah. So the procedure, the first one, you wring the head, but you don't take the head off of it. And then you sprinkle the blood on the altar. Like, it's like the imagery of like opening a soda can and kind of like getting the stuff out of it, or like soy sauce or something. I don't know. The second one is offered as a burnt offering. So it takes two birds to do what you can do with one bigger animal. So that's why you need the two different things. And so if you were poor, that was one of the provisions. I guess two birds is still cheaper than a bull, obviously. But then, even if you can't even afford birds, what provision is given in 11 through 13? Fine flour. How much can you bring?
A tenth of
an ephah? What's an ephah?
It's 11.
2 liters of Mountain Dew. 22 liters is an ephah. A tenth of that is 2.2 liters, so it's about a 2 liter. And so you bring a tenth of an ephah. That's also called an omer in Exodus 16, so there is a term for that. But could even the poorest people get grain in Israel?
Yes. And what books of the Bible show poor people gleaning the harvest? Ruth did. And so Leviticus 23, talking about the Feast of Booths,
it's going to talk about how you have to leave the edges for the poor people. So even the poorest among them could still bring something that would allow them to be forgiven. Now, have you ever noticed this in Hebrews? There's this small exception given in Hebrews about something. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, it says, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. Have you ever wondered what the almost means?
Well, I think it might be for the really poor people that couldn't bring a blood offering, but they could bring a grain offering. And so that's why it's an almost sort of thing. But unlike the grain offering, there's no oil, there's no frankincense in this one. So there's some differences with the grain offering.
But the main point that I want to see just from this last section here is that God wanted everybody to have the opportunity to be forgiven. Rich or poor, if you don't have any animals, you can go glean. But you still have to do something to get this provision. If you're really poor, it's not like you're just such a victim that you don't have to do anything and it's all going to be done for you. No, you still have to go do something. But God is doing everything he can in this system to make it so it's available to everybody. Any comments or questions on that?
Yes.
I just wondered about who determined whether he was able or not.
Yeah. That's a good question.
It would depend on his heart, and yeah. God would judge the heart.
Right. Because what if there was like a really stingy, like covetous Israelite man that like had a big business and everything, and like he could bring, you know, and he's like, well, I got the birds today. And like, could the priest go like, we all know you. You know, like that, we all know what you're trying to do right now. I don't know if there would have been conversations like that. But yeah, that's a good thing to try to imagine. Anything else you guys want to say about the sin offering? All right.
Then we move to, okay, well, here's just another chart that shows. So the sin offering, if it's the high priest or the congregation that sinned, you have to bring a bull. The blood is sprinkled by the altar, put on the incense altar. The officiants, the high priest, all this kind of, so if it's the leader or the Israelite. I just paired these together so you see that if it's the high priest or the congregation, it's pretty much the same thing. If it's the leader or the Israelites, it's pretty much the same thing with just a couple differences with the male versus female options. So that chart will just be there as a way to visualize everything we just talked about. Okay, so then we move to the guilt offering. The guilt offering is given when property has been mishandled. Now, it's going to break it up where it talks about how we could defraud God like misappropriate his property. And then it's also going to talk about how you could defraud your neighbor. What are the two greatest commands? Yeah. Love God, love neighbor. So we'll see how this breaks down in just a second. But anybody know any of the other words that are used to describe the guilt offering? There's some other translations that use some other terms. Trespass offering, because it's something with property. Any other words that you guys have used, heard to have described this one? Some people call it the reparation offering, because it's the idea of reparation means that you are repairing damages that you inflicted. So it's a reparation. So those are a couple ways to think about this. So look at in chapter 5, verses 14 through 19. We'll read just part of this. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "If anyone commits a breach of faith and sins unintentionally in any of the holy things of the Lord, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation a ram without blemish out of the flock, valued in silver shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, for a guilt offering. He shall also make restitution for what he has done amiss in the holy thing, and shall add a fifth to it, and give it to the priest. And the priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and he shall be forgiven." Okay. So if you defraud God, in this situation, in verses 14 through 16, this is a known offense. When you can acknowledge something that you've done against God's sacred objects or sacred things, what would be some ways that you could mishandle the sacred objects or things that belong to God?
I don't know if by touching something you weren't supposed to, or entering an area you weren't supposed to.
Okay.
And of course, Uzzah got struck dead for touching himself, but that was ultimate ark.
Right. Right. So maybe it's like
you stumble upon the tabernacle. You're playing football or whatever they'd play, stickball. I don't know. And like somebody throws it a little bit too high, and you like you bump into the tabernacle and like knock part of it. I don't know. It would be something like that. What about, did God get portions of the offerings, like the memorial portions that were burnt up? Like, what if you were bringing one of the, like, the tithes or the first fruits, and you didn't really bring the full tenth? Or you didn't really bring the best of what you had? Well, that's the stuff that belongs to God. And so if you do something like that, that's a breach of faith. That term in verse 15, breach of faith, is used in other places to talk about husbands or wives cheating on each other. That this is, you have not been giving God what is due him. And so what you have to do, once you acknowledge this, is add a fifth to what was mishandled. So it amounts to a double tithe now. 20% is a double tithe. And so if you would have just done the tithe the right way the first time, whatever, now you've got to add 20% to the damages that you did. So that's if you know that you've offended God in some way. Any comments or questions about that one?
Wouldn't that be what Malachi is pretty much about?
Yes. Yeah, Malachi is telling them that they
haven't been giving God what's due him and all of this this sort of stuff. And so I think there would have been a lot of guilt offerings that needed to be made for them. Verses 17 through 19 is if you've offended God, but you can't identify how. So it's kind of like, have you ever had a time before where you're like, just imagine being an Israelite and you were supposed to bring a tithe of something. And you're like, I think I don't know that I actually measured it the right way. Can you imagine being in a situation like that? But you don't know exactly how much you didn't bring and how much you were supposed to bring. Like afterwards, like, I think I mismeasured that. Or I think when we brought the first fruits that there was, I don't think we got all of them, or, you know, whatever it could be. So if you can't quantify it, but you feel like you did something wrong, you just bring a ram without blemish. But you can't add a fifth to anything because you don't know exactly what the quantity was. And you can see how realistic situations like that would be. Like, how many of us have looked back on a conversation we had and we go, I don't know if I handled that exactly the right way. Or, like, but it's like something you can't quantify, but you like want to pray to God that he would forgive you for that. That's the same sort of thing here. Any thoughts or comments on that? In both cases, you bring a ram or the equivalent. It seems like it's saying you can bring the equivalent amount of money that a ram would be worth, I think.
Nana?
It makes me think of Zacchaeus when he was
Yes. Payback. Yep. Payback fourfold. That's right.
All right, anything else about the guilt offering? About defrauding God?
Because in chapter 6, 1
through 7, you move to if you defraud your neighbor, and here are the circumstances that you might defraud your neighbor, in case you didn't know. You take something that's entrusted to you and you mismanage it. Remember in 2 Kings 6, where you've got the sons of the prophets, one of them had borrowed an axe, and what happened to the axe? Yeah, he had an
accident. Get it? It's funny. So the axe head goes, yeah, I know. It goes into the
river, and then Elijah gets it to float, but he's worried that it was borrowed. I have mismanaged something that was entrusted to me, and I have to pay back the axe head plus 20% of it, is the idea. So that would be a circumstance you need to do that. Robbery, don't do that. You also have withholding what belongs to others, like somebody has entrusted to you something and you don't give it back to them or whatever because you're holding a grudge over somebody something, or finding property and lying about it. So all of these would be circumstances where you have defrauded your neighbor in some way, and the nature of the repayment is the same thing as it was with God. You repay the item plus 20%, so it's 100%, 120% total. And what Nanette just said, bringing up Zacchaeus in Luke 19, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I restore it fourfold." Is that more than 120%? Yeah, like, he's going beyond. Would it be okay to do that? Yeah, but this is like the minimum, I think, is the idea. Okay, so that's how that works. The offering itself, look at verses 6 and 7. This is
David said it should be returned when the sheep had been taken.
In 2 Samuel 12, when the prophet comes to him?
Yeah, I believe it's fourfold.
Does he say that? It would be 2 Samuel 12?
I'll look it up.
Okay, all right. All right, look at verses 6 and 7.
And he shall bring to the priests as his compensation to the Lord a ram without blemish out of the flock or its equivalent for a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven for any of the things that one may do and thereby become guilty. All right. What's the order? In verse 5, what is the first thing the guy has to do before he can go bring his offering at the altar?
Does that sound like anything Jesus ever said? Remember in the Sermon on the Mount that
before you make your offering, before you go to the altar, make things right with your brother first and then bring your offering? Same principle. This comes from Leviticus.
But then you also have
to bring a ram or the equivalent for the guilt offering. So there you go. Like, look at these laws that are, like, it's saying your property, if you're going to harm somebody, if you're going to harm somebody's property, you're harming the owner of the property as well. The Bible acknowledges personal property rights. That's what these things are dealing with here. So it's not Marxism. Okay, so anything anybody wants to say about this? Is restored the lamb fourfold? Okay, all right. Interesting. All right, so that's the guilt offering. And then you go to the laws for the priests. Those are just some things that we just looked at, another visual way of remembering what we just looked at. Okay, so the laws for the priests, the rest of this section, we're going to zoom through this really quick. But the first six chapters or so, this is the order, the burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering, sin offering, guilt offering. So all of these things help connect you to God. They help restore broken relationships with the reparations. But then also, now we move to the address to the priests. And what this section is going to do is it's going to say, all right, specifically to the priests, we just told the whole people what they have to do. Now we move to the priests, because as you are officiating these sacrifices, here's some specific things you need to know about when people bring these offerings. So this loosely follows what we've seen. It's going to address the priests about the burnt offering, the grain offering. It's not going to deal with the peace offering because it's the same procedure as if it were the sin offering. And then it's going to move to the guilt offering and then say some things about the fellowship offering. Okay, so that's the outline of this next section. Does that make sense, though? You move from the people to the priests who help the people make the offerings. Okay, just to highlight a couple things here with this. The continual burnt offering, I think this is the only one that I want to read. Look at verses 8 through 13. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth, on the altar, all night until the morning, and the fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. And the priest shall put on his linen garment and put his linen undergarment on his body, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire has reduced the burnt offering on the altar and put them beside the altar. Then he shall take off his garment and put on the other garments and carry the ashes outside the camp to be clean, to a clean place. The fire on the altar shall be kept burning on it. It shall not go out. The priest shall burn wood on it every morning, and he shall arrange the burnt offering on it and shall burn it on it the fat of the peace offerings. Fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. It shall not go out. Okay. First time, priest directly addressed, already said that. What is the idea of this passage, though? What do they always have to have available at the brazen altar? Fire. Now, and when they're handling the ashes and everything, there's specific clothes that they only wear in the tabernacle. But the brazen altar is always burning. How many sacrifices every day just for the priests do they have to offer at this brazen altar? Two. The morning and the evening. What time was the morning one? 9. What time was the evening one? 3. That spans the time Jesus was on the cross, by the way. And so when Jesus breathes his last breath on the cross, that would have been the time of the evening sacrifice. And when he got on it, that would have been the time of the morning sacrifice. Okay, so he's saying that when you offer the evening sacrifice, that you just let it burn all night. Why should the brazen altar always be burning? Any ideas on that?
Certainly would be a reminder of what needed to be done.
Yeah. If it was always burning, what was always available to the people? Atonement.
It's a beautiful picture. Like, if you think about the brazen altar, it's not like, oh, we have to get our Zippo out again and start this fire. It was all, like, there would have been ashes that you have to kind of rekindle, then the ashes from the night before, like, you have to clear the old ones away, change your clothes, go out and put it in a clean place. But the idea being that you could always, like, blow on it, and, like, it would start going again. And so, for us, atonement is always available. If you were an Israelite, you had sinned at 3 a.m., you theoretically should be able to go to the tabernacle and have atonement for your sins. Look at how gracious God is and all these provisions he's giving the people. And now we talked about what happens if they're tenting, like the tabernacle's been deconstructed and they're on their move to the next place that they're going to set up. Do you remember the provision for that situation in Numbers? Remember it was like the instant coffee mix? Remember when we talked about this? The water that had what mixed into it? The ashes of the red heifer, right? So there was provisions made in situations like that when they didn't have this thing burning all the time. And so it's always burning. Again, like I said earlier, the word fire in Hebrew is olah. And in Hebrew, that's related to the word holocaust, to mean to burn. Okay, so that's the continual burning. Anything you guys want to say about that?
Okay.
So the rest of this, the priests are constantly working. That's just a thing that Hebrews kind of says Jesus was able to sit down now. All right, we're just going to zoom through the rest of this. So for the grain offerings, when the Israelites would bring grain offerings, what do the priests specifically need to know? Because chapter 2 helped the offerer know what to do. So for the grain offering, if the Israelites are going to bring this grain offering, the priestly portion, the part that the priest could eat, it has to be eaten in the court of the tabernacle. That's the main instruction for that. But it's not just that the priests handle the grain offerings of others. The priests themselves have to offer grain offerings. And that's what verses 19 through 23 talks about. And so the priests are not above the law. Every priest in Aaron's line must be giving grain offerings from the offerings that they received. So they're tithing the tithe that they received from the people. But this brings up one of those principles that is also taught in the New Testament, that people who work for the Lord are compensated by the people that they're serving. So thanks for supporting me, guys. Okay, anything you guys want to say about the grain offering?
All right, so the sin offering, what if it's a sin
offering that somebody's bringing? If the priest gets his garments with like splashing with blood on it, you have to wash the bloody garments. If you do it with an earthenware vessel, the blood soaks into it, so you have to break the vessel because it now has blood on it. But if it was with a bronze vessel, the blood doesn't soak in, so you just have to wash the vessel really well. The eating instructions, because the priest got to eat some of the sin offering, that you get to eat portions of it except for when it's the priest that has sinned or the people, because that blood is brought into the tabernacle like we said earlier. Okay, so that's good for the priest to know. The guilt offering in 7:1-7, the meat has to be eaten in the holy place. The blood is treated the same as the burnt or the peace offering. So you've got the continuity going on there. Look at verses 8 through 10 of chapter 7. Look at Leviticus chapter 7, verses 8 through 10. And the priest who offers any man's burnt offering shall have for himself the skin of the burnt offering that he has offered, and every grain offering baked in the oven, and all that is prepared on a pan or on a griddle shall belong to the priest who offers it. And every grain offering mixed with oil or dry shall be shared equally among all the sons of Aaron. Okay, so here's like the tips. So if you're the priest, here's the tip. If you're the one that like somebody comes up to bring a burnt offering, what do you get to keep from it? The skin, the hide. What would a priest want to do with the hide of an animal?
What do you say?
You sell it or make some kind of garment out of it.
Yeah, you can make a garment out of it. Did people have Nalgene water bottles back then? What would you drink from? Yeah, from the skins, right? So, like, there's a lot of things that they could use for these hides. And so this is one of the ways that, like, the priests who didn't have large pasture lands, they did have pasture lands, but not large ones, this would be a way that they could have some things provided for them. Jerry?
That was one thing when you said that the priest couldn't profit from the offering for his own sin. In that case, the hide was to be burned.
Yep.
It specifically says that the hide is to be burned with the others.
In chapter 4?
Yeah.
Yeah, what verse was that?
I just looked at it. 4:11.
Yep. Yeah, that's everything is burned. That's right. Everything that they could benefit from. Yep, good. Okay. Yeah, so
John the Baptist had a leather girdle and his father was a priest.
Oh, yeah, that's good. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Do you guys all hear what Sewell said? That John the Baptist's father was a priest, and that he had this leather belt. So like maybe it's like, oh yeah, somebody brought this bowl, and like, okay, I'm going to give this to little
John the Baptist, and this will be his belt when he's older. Yeah, Teresa.
I'm not 100% sure, but Danny can correct us. But when he took us to the place to see some of the Bible stuff, their tents were made out of some hide.
That's right.
And it kept the rain from.
Right. That's right. So these animals, like people talk about the
Native Americans and how if they killed like a what are the big animals that they would kill? But they would use every single part of it. Like God is not just wasting stuff here, and so I think that's cool to see that. So if you were the officiating priest when somebody brought a grain offering, your tip was that you got to eat the cooked grain. Can you imagine like the priests like they're all like lined up like ready for somebody to come and like, no, I'm getting this one. You know, like that kind of thing because that they're kind of hungry. I don't know. Pancakes, whatever. Because we talked about the variety of different ways you could cook them and all this kind of stuff. If it was an uncooked offering, it's shared by all the priests. So if it's a grain offering but it's not been cooked, then that one gets shared by all of them, not just like a tip for the officiating priest. Okay. So you're seeing a lot of details in all of this. Notice this pretty much the last section here is the peace offerings. So the peace offerings, there's different reasons that you would give a peace offering. You're giving thanks to God. It's because you've made a vow and God has answered your prayer, or it's a free will thing. You're just doing this just because you're really thankful right now or whatever, for no like particular reason, I guess. That the priests need to know that when somebody brings a peace offering, if it's for Thanksgiving, you eat the meat on the day that it was brought to you. If it was a vow or a free will, you have to eat it on the first or the second day. The rest of the meat ends up getting burned. And so it's just, these are just procedures that these people would need to know. And as they're eating the peace offerings, there's two prohibitions. You don't eat unclean things. If you've touched something unclean, you don't wash in that, you don't eat in that state. If the meat you're about to eat has touched something that's unclean, you don't eat it in that state. And you also don't eat the fat or the blood like we've talked about before. And the portion that they get is the breast and the right thigh of the peace offering. So very detailed that the implication is that the offerer would receive the left thigh. So that's where we get this idea, I think, that it was shared by the worshipers as well as the priest. Okay, so that's that's that one. Let's then conclude this section here. Look at verses 37 and 38. This is the law of the burnt offering, of the grain offering, of the sin offering, and of the guilt offering, and of the ordination offering. What is that one? And of the peace offering, of which the Lord commanded Moses at Mount Sinai on the day that he commanded the people of Israel to bring their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai. Okay, so here's the summary of this section specifically for the priests. This is the first mention of the ordination offering, though. Seems like a weird way to summarize this section because we haven't even read about that. So what is that all about? It's for the priests, and it's going to be mentioned in chapter 8. But why do you do a summary section bringing up something that hasn't been mentioned yet? It's the same procedure as one of the offerings, but not that one. It's the same procedure as the fellowship offering. And this is why I say, when you start to look at the details of this, well, the sin offering, that same procedure was followed if you gave birth. It didn't mean you sinned by giving birth. And so these offerings can kind of be moved around a little bit, the same procedures, but sometimes they're called something different because they're for a particular purpose. Does that make sense? And so, like, I hope we can get, like, comfortable enough with, or, like, familiar enough with these things where we're like, oh, yeah, the peace offering, that's just, like, the same procedure as the sin offering, just different purposes. And so that's what the Israelites would have to get accustomed to. Okay, so it says that these instructions were given at Mount Sinai. I thought that they were given at the tabernacle in Leviticus 1:1.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. Some people
have suggested that these are given out of chronological order, that in Exodus 29, when God is giving instructions about handling sacrifices, that he also added these last two chapters here that we just looked at. Or it's just that they're still at the base of Mount Sinai, so it's not that complicated. Okay, I want to conclude this class just with this idea. So far in what we're seeing in Leviticus, these offerings are teaching us different angles of what sin is. So, when you think about the burnt offering, it's teaching you that sinners are guilty and deserve to die. And the animal is dying. If it is the peace offering, it's showing you that sin severs a relationship with God. If it is a sin offering, it shows you that sin makes things dirty and you've got to cleanse it by the blood. You sprinkle it on the veil. It's like the blood is being used as this detergent of sorts. And so sin makes you dirty. Or the guilt offering is it causes debt. Like I owe something to somebody. Jesus will talk about sin in that same way in the Sermon on the Mount. How does he say it? Forgive us the trespasses as we've forgiven those who have trespassed against us. And yeah, forgive us our debts. He uses that same imagery in the Sermon. One of the pictures of sin, there's many metaphors for sin in the Bible. One of them is it's debt. That who ultimately paid for us? Christ. So you see how when Galatians says that all of this stuff was a tutor to bring us to the knowledge of what Jesus did, all of these things were necessary so that they would understand in a deeper way Jesus' sacrifice and what that means for them and everything. So any final comments or questions anybody wants to make?
His sacrifice was all of them. Yes. He is the purple of the tabernacle because he's royalty. He's also the people serving within the tabernacle. He's also the table of showbread because he's the bread of life. He's also the candlestick that's in the temple. When you look at the foreshadowings of Jesus, it's not like a one-to-one logical parallel. He's just everything. And so I hope we're seeing that as we go through this. I don't know that we're going to go this fast-paced through every section of Leviticus. These first seven chapters, I think it's good to do this like we have. But next time we'll look at chapters 8, 9, and 10, where we see the ordination of the priests and then the incineration of Nadab and Abihu. But does anybody want to make any final comments or questions from anything we've looked at? All right, so I know we went through a lot of this really quickly. The reason that I'm giving you the notes is because if some of this was really quick or whatever, you can go back and look at some of this, and the notes are up here available to anybody who wants them. So let's go ahead and pray. Our gracious Father, we thank you so much that that even though we've sinned against you, even though we've harmed you and we've harmed others, that you are the one who has made the payment. Father, we pray that that we would make the efforts towards receiving that payment, and that we would make those efforts towards being established in a relationship with you. We thank you so much for these pictures of what you've done for us in the Old Testament. We pray that it would cause our hearts to burn, just like those who were on the road to Emmaus. Father, we pray that these things would incite zeal in our hearts so that we would be more and more in love with you and the things that you've provided for us. We thank you for Jesus and his sacrifice, and it's in his name we pray. Amen.